That's why, incidentally, this idea that you sometimes hear that we don't need to go to school, we don't need to learn any facts or information anymore because we can just look it up, is nonsense. Creativity comes from having a well-stocked mind, that kind of incredibly well-stocked basement of the subconscious mind. The more you can pack down there below, right, the more kind of amazing and rich and diverse material you have deeply learnt over the years, the better at critical thinking, at creativity, at innovation, at imagination you will be.
This is Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. If you're new here, I'm an author. I started out on my own as a self-employed independent creator 10 years ago. I've been trying to make a living doing things that I love to do, and I've been sharing what I've been learning along the way right here on this show. So if you've ever had a lot of free time, you know how scary it can be. The very first day that I was on my own more than 10 years ago, I woke up to just vastness, and I had this whole day ahead of me that I needed to fill up with something. I figured that I'd have the best shot of making it if I could just kind of follow my curiosity. I figured I might be able to make it. So I'd start with curiosity. I figured I could keep myself from getting off track and wasting time if I started with curiosity. I also figured that I would end up somewhere special. And most importantly, I figured that it would ensure that I would end up doing something that I loved to do. So I followed my curiosity. I ended up combining my interests in design and in programming and in entrepreneurship, and that became my first book, Design for Hackers. Now, following your curiosity can be really powerful, but how is it that you can deal with having disparate curiosities? How do you make sure that you're actually being productively curious? Our guest today wrote a book about curiosity. It's called Curious, The Desire to Know and Why Your Future Depends on It. In it, Ian Leslie, our guest today, explains what curiosity is, why it's important, and why there's a growing curiosity divide. Some people are getting more curious, while others are getting less curious. The more curious people will be at a distinct advantage as the world gets more complex and traditional work starts to get more scarce. So in this conversation, we're going to talk about what's the difference between diversive curiosity and epistemic curiosity. One can get us off track, while the other one can really pay off. If you have a lot of varied interests, how do you manage your curiosity? You want curiosity to pay off, but you don't want to be merely distracting yourself from being productive. And also, a popular opinion these days is that you shouldn't bother memorizing anything or learning anything, to take that one step further, I guess, because you can just look it up. Now, Ian explains why he disagrees with this. Learn why a well-stocked mind is your best tool for breakthrough creative insights. And I talked to Ian for more than an hour, but that's more than we were able to put in the show today. We pay by the minute for editing the podcast, so we edited the conversation down to the most critical elements about being productively curious. So if you are a Love Your Work Elite member, be sure to listen to the full uncut interview for some bonus listening. There are some gems in there. In particular, towards the end, I asked Ian how it is that he thinks about writing book proposals. I know that I've struggled myself with writing book proposals. It seems like you have to write the whole book before you can write the proposal, before you can then get the book deal to write the book for real. So as is usually the case, when I get a chance to ask my author guests something specific about how they do their work, it really flips a switch in my brain. What Ian said to me has really helped me with the book proposal that I'm working on right now. All of that and the rest of the conversation is available exclusively to Love Your Work Elite members. That's the only way to hear the full conversation. You can get it right on your own personal custom RSS feed. About 15 minutes of this conversation ended up on the cutting room floor. So if you're not a member yet, go to lywelite.com to join. Again, that's lywelite.com. And we have a new Love Your Work Elite member, this time at the $99 a month mini sponsorship level, Ed Stanfield. Thank you so much for joining. Ed says, I've been listening to your podcast for quite a while and I really enjoy it. Don't quit. Thank you for the encouragement, Ed. Your support means so much, and it really goes a long way. Check out Ed's website at startwithclarity.com. The Clarity Journal is a daily journaling practice that reveals your self-destructive patterns of behavior that are preventing you from achieving true productivity. Again, check out Ed's Clarity Journal at startwithclarity.com. And with Ed's $99 a month pledge, all publishing expenses are now listener supported. That means that all of the hosting of the audio files, which is delivering this audio to you, that is listener supported. And the help that I hire to get the episodes published and scheduled so that they hit your podcast app every Thursday, all of that is listener supported too. So we're now more than halfway to our next goal of having all production expenses listener supported. And that would mean that the people that I hire to edit the show, the ones that make the sound quality so great, that would be listener supported along with the publishing expenses. So now is a great time to join Love Your Work Elite, not just because of that goal, but because there are new Love Your Work t-shirts. I'm wearing one right now. It's super soft. I love it. You can walk around with Love Your Work written on your shirt. It's there. You know, I find that when I'm wearing it, it reminds me to make the right decisions to build the life that I want. And, you know, maybe it inspires some others to do the same when they see me wearing the shirt. I don't know. You can get a huge discount on these Love Your Work t-shirts for joining Love Your Work Elite right now through the end of the month, now through October 31st. Listen carefully to this. When you join Love Your Work Elite, you will get 30% off the Love Your Work t-shirt. And this is true if you promote your business through the $99 a month pledge that Ed signed up for. This is also true if you just sign up to buy me a cup of tea once a month. Really, if you think about it, listening to this podcast, you're kind of having tea with me, or if you like coffee, like several times a month, four times a month. So if you were to buy me a cup of tea once a month, you would still get 30% off of the Love Your Work t-shirt. So to do that, get 30% off the new amazingly soft tri-blend Love Your Work t-shirt, go to lywelite.com. That's lywelite.com. I'm here with Ian Leslie, author of Curious. Ian, how was it that you got so curious about curiosity, which I'm sure is a question everybody asks you?
Yeah, I mean, so like probably you and a lot of your most of the listeners, your podcast, I have always been a curious person. And as I got older, that's something that I reflected on more and more, because you start to realize that some people that you meet are intensely curious and some people are not, right? You sit down to lunch with somebody or to at a dinner party, whatever it is, or in a business meeting, you can tell pretty quickly whether or not that person is truly curious, or whether or not they're just going through the motions of conversation, or whether or not they just want to have an efficient kind of conversation where, you know, we go through the kind of the ritual of having a conversation without me actually being interested in you, what you do, what you care about. You know, I'm prejudiced. I like curious people more than incurious people. And it was struck me that it seems like a better way to live, right? It seems so obvious that it's much better to go around in your life learning, to always, you know, be kind of have your mind stimulated, both in what you read and in who you talk to and what you find out from them. The question arose in my mind, you know, why are some people curious and why are some people incurious? So I sort of coined this phrase for the beginning of the book, which was the curiosity divide. And started thinking about, you know, why is there a curiosity divide? And then the more I researched that and thought about that, the more it became evident to me that this is a particularly important time to be curious. There are higher and higher rewards to knowledge in the economy and the society that we live in. And there are higher and higher rewards to people who are very intellectually adaptive, who can kind of switch and pivot from one job to another, from one business to another, but also within the workplace, from one type of knowledge to another, one type of skill to another. And so there's this massive kind of premium on curiosity. And, you know, if we're in danger of being a society where the curious people, all the rewards go to the kind of elite who are curious, and people who are incurious sort of drop further and further behind. So I guess the kind of underlying mission of my book is to say, you know, let's all be more curious. And then I kind of set out to find out, how does that work? How can you be more curious?
I definitely talk to people a lot who, and this is something I've experienced myself, who say, oh, I just have all these disparate interests. You know, how do I get myself to focus on one of them? Which is a decent tactic in some ways, but I fear that people are really missing out on something when they sort of purposefully don't follow their curiosities. Would you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I absolutely do. And I think it's a really interesting question. And it's one that I still ponder what the right balance is between, you know, kind of going into depth and becoming expert in what you know and learning, you know, and learning new, because there's just this endless kind of variety of different fields of knowledge. So in the book, it's actually a concept borrowed from artificial intelligence, actually. And they talk about the exploitation dilemma. So when you're designing any kind of, you know, intelligent machine, that's one of the questions you have to work out is how much should it be programmed to explore and learn, and how much should it be programmed to exploit what it already knows? And that's the question that we're all faced with, right? So if you only explore, then, you know, you never really kind of learn anything properly because you're always going on to the next thing. You can't actually get anything done because you're always kind of exploring and moving on. So you need to be exploiting what you already know as well and kind of getting better at that. But if you only exploit what you already know, then you stagnate, you know, and you stop kind of really kind of growing, learning, innovating, and so on. And if you look at the kind of the structure of human lifespan, it's really interesting because, you know, humans spend a long time very helpless, right? I mean, much more than other mammals. So, you know, a baby lamb, a foal are up, kind of up and running and dating, you know, within days, within weeks, and kind of getting on with their life. But humans have this long phase of really being utterly dependent on others. You know, for some of us, well into our 30s, you know, let's be clear about this. It's kind of really one of the most striking characteristics of human species, right? And it seems, it's counterintuitive, right? Because we are, you know, we're a very successful species in terms of our sophistication and domination of the planet. But so why do we spend so long just not doing anything, you know, not being able to get anything done? And so we're in explore mode for this really kind of long time before we get to start exploiting it. And it just seems that, you know, we've been designed to have this long period where we are just taking in huge amounts of data from our senses. And then as we kind of become conscious, we start to understand language and so on. And we're learning from our elders as well, from our parents, and then from teachers and so on. And then as we get older, we start to exploit that more, right? So we start to be able to do things, to make breakfast, whatever it is. And then we kind of have this balance of exploration and exploitation. But as you go through the lifespan, then you start to explore less and you start to exploit more, right? And that's a good thing. So when people say, oh yeah, well, curiosity declines as children grow up and we should blame that on schools. That's terrible. So, well, you know, don't be so hasty to say that, because actually, you know, if you were just this Rousseauian kind of like exploring child, you know, throughout your whole childhood, then you would really be pretty miserable. I mean, it just wouldn't work. You need to kind of get some stuff done, right? You know, learn some skills, understand what things are for, how to use them. But of course, the opposite is also true. If you stop wanting, if you stop asking why, stop asking questions, then you kind of atrophy. So that's a very long answer to your question. So just coming back to what your dilemma about, you know, when people say, well, you know, I just don't know what to focus on. That question really never goes away. I don't think it's an easy answer to it. And it's not one that if you look at my writing, you know, I write about, nutrition science. I've written about the science of apps and behavior change. I've written about, advertising. At the moment, I'm writing about interrogation science. It means that people don't necessarily know what I'm going to write about, which is, in a sense, not a good thing, because people can't say, oh, Ian Leslie, he's the guy that does this.
Like personal branding, right?
Yeah. It goes against all the rules of personal branding. But in another sense, you know, screw personal branding. I'm writing about what I'm interested in. And you know, you got to have faith that actually people will kind of see there's some sort of common sensibility to everything I do, and they'll start to draw their own conclusions. And
what do you think that common sensibility is for you?
I don't know. And in a way, I'm not really too bothered about trying to work out what it is. And I'm sort of happy to see if other people think there is one and let them work it out. But I'm pretty sure it's something to do with being interested in things and making things interesting to other people. So I love kind of taking complex subjects or subjects that perhaps people haven't thought about much and really kind of making them interesting and making them exciting for people. I love telling stories around complex issues. So I like to write in a way that means that people don't want to stop reading. Right. Even when I'm writing about something really kind of quite dense and complicated. So that's my challenge. I don't know if it actually comes across, but that's the way I kind of see my job.
Yeah, it kind of has its own challenge within it. So I think that, the exploitation exploration thing is interesting, too, because I guess I've always, you know, throughout my career, whenever I've kind of taken a job or something, I've always wanted it to be something that where I was kind of getting paid to learn, especially early on in my career. But then you sort of end up in something where, you know, maybe you can make a pretty good amount of money doing stuff that you already know how to do, and you're not necessarily learning a whole lot. I guess my strategy has been to do those things, do as little of them as possible, and spend the rest of the time exploring things. Is that kind of the way that you operate too?
Yeah, it is. I mean, you need the security of, you know, you need to know where your next check's going to come from. You need to have a rough idea anyway. But you also need to be placing bets. A well-known example of this would be, Steve Jobs is took a course in calligraphy when he was at university, in a sense you could think about that as a side bet, right? On a slot machine that didn't look very promising at all. Like, he probably wasn't expecting to kind of do much with that calligraphy course, but he did it because he was interested, right? He was following his curiosity.
I mean, it's a pretty famous example, but I think just to clarify, you know, he was dropping in on classes in college and was just dropped in this calligraphy course, fell in love with typography, right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. And you probably know the story better than me, but yeah. So just fell in love with typography, as you say. And then, when they were designing the interface, you know, years later, when he was involved in the design of the interface for the first Mac, which of course became the interface for Windows and therefore pretty much everybody's interface for personal computers, he was the one who insisted on there being a selection of different fonts. Otherwise, we could all be typing on, you know, in sans serif, sort of very dull kind of single font.
Just jagged. It looks like it was made with Legos and stuff. There were a selection of fonts. They were
classic
optically. They thought about how they would how the spacing was between the letters, you know, which is a challenge in pixels.
Yeah, right. Indeed. Yeah. So it was a costly thing to do, right? It wasn't a kind of obvious thing to do. And the world is better off for it. You know, he was doing that because he was interested. And the thing is, like, you never really know whether or not your time is wasted or not. When you're learning something, of course, you know, when it's, if you're just playing like Angry Birds, whatever it is, then yeah, okay, you are pretty much wasting time. But the great thing about curiosity is that when you are exercising your curiosity, which means when you are, you know, paying attention to something rich and interesting, which could be reading a book, could be talking to somebody interesting, could be just looking at something, could be traveling, whatever it is. Whenever you're exercising your curiosity, you are not wasting your time. Like, you don't know if you're, or put it this way, you don't know how valuable that time is going to be. But you know it has some value because you're learning something, right? But it could be like that second slot machine. It could be something that pays off in some huge way later on in your life. And I find that quite exciting. So I think that's a kind of a reason to keep the kind of exploration side of things going. It's not an easy question to answer, because the other side of this is, okay, if I disperse my curiosity too widely, then I'm always kind of like learning little bits of everything, and I'm not really kind of going. And one of the great rewards of life is going into things in depth and accumulating knowledge over a long period of time. So in the book, I talk about this very fundamental distinction that kind of runs throughout the book, drawn from the literature, the psychological literature on this, which is between diversive curiosity and epistemic curiosity, right? The slightly technical terms, but they're pretty straight.
Kind of the difference between the Angry Birds that you're talking about and...
Angry Birds, or looking at like cat videos, I would not call curiosity at all. So I'd take those off the table and say, that's not curiosity. That is basically your attention.
Ah, I got you. But, okay.
Yeah. So that's just, you know, I mean, you know, fun, but no, I wouldn't call it curiosity. Diversive curiosity is the hunger for new information, right? So diversive curiosity is absolutely necessary, because it's where curiosity starts. It's the thing that takes you off the beaten path. So you're going through your daily routine, whatever you do, and then you go, oh, hang on, what's that? And it could be opening an email or clicking on a tweet. It could be picking up a book, could be something that makes you go, oh, okay, I'm going to try and find out what's going on here. That very basic urge, that's, you know, usually what we call the itch of curiosity. That's diversive curiosity. And that's the real kind of, that's the fire starter of curiosity, okay? And then there's epistemic curiosity, which is actually accumulating knowledge. It's a kind of, what happens to diversive curiosity when it grows up, right? It's a kind of like deeper and ultimately more sustaining and enriching kind of form of curiosity. And it requires, as the key thing about it, focused attention. It requires effort. Right. So diversive curiosity doesn't really require any effort at all. It just sort of happens to us. We go, oh, I need to find that out. Okay. I need to see that. I need to look. I need to click, whatever it is. Which is fine. Cause like I say, that's where it starts. But unless it's converted into epistemic curiosity, where you actually say, okay, now I'm going to really concentrate and focus on this. I'm going to take up biology as my major, and I'm really going to get interested in it. I'm going to learn everything about the history of biology, and perhaps I'll do it as a career. You know, but to take it right to it is extreme. That's epistemic curiosity. And really the book is saying, look, it's great. Diversive curiosity is great. But really for it to really enrich your life, you've got to focus on, you know, keeping that muscle, that epistemic curiosity muscle alive and powerful.
This is where I feel like it's valuable to go ahead and trust the curiosity, that it will kind of come from that diversive curiosity. It will grow into epistemic curiosity. I know that the speech that you were just citing, the Steve Jobs speech, that was something that I was watching that over and over again when I first started out on my own like 10 years ago. And there's this idea that you can't connect the dots moving forward. You can only connect them moving in reverse. And so you should trust your heart and intuition, as he says. But to me, that means curiosity. And so that was something that I personally made sure to do. And, you know, my curiosity brought me in all sorts of different directions, but eventually those different directions converged.
I think trust your curiosity, like you say. But also, in a way, it does require a bit of self-management as well, because I think you also have to say, look, here are a few things that I think I want to know more about, and I want to spend a long time, maybe even a lifetime, learning and deepening and enriching my knowledge of. So in a way, I'm kind of saying, be infinitely curious, you know, exercise your diversity of curiosity about everything that comes, you know, be interested in everything, but know a few things really well. And that's the secret of happiness. You know, that's the secret of everything, I think, you know, be interested in everything, learn a little about a lot, but also make sure that you know a lot about a little, you know, make sure there are a few things on which you know more than the average person. That's a low bar, at the very least more than the average person, but actually, you know, really as much as you can.
And do you find it helpful? I think this is something that I do once in a while is maybe I am kind of going off on some kind of a tangent with curiosity, and I'll take some time to sort of brainstorm about how might this relate to things that I've done in the past, and how might it connect and become new and interesting things. Is that anything that you do personally?
Yeah, I do. And I have a great respect for my unconscious mind, or my kind of subconscious, semi-conscious mind. So I think a lot of that connecting of things goes on under the hood, right? And I think you have to kind of just, and that has a couple, that's a few implications for how you live and how you think about it. One of them is patience. So say you're trying to crack a problem, or you're trying to find some insight, or you're just trying to learn something, and you're kind of intensively reading around it, and no kind of flash of insight or inspiration or idea has come to you yet, and you keep reading and you think, okay, well, I'm taking stuff in, but nothing's really. Just be patient. Go and do something else, and you know, just give it a few hours at least. Well, actually, you know, give it a few days, or perhaps give it a few weeks or months. It doesn't. At some
or years.
Point, your unconscious mind will make the connection and will go, ah, yeah, okay. It just kind of churns over in the background there, and eventually turns into something. So number one, be patient, and number two, make sure you have time in your life for that kind of daydreamy, mind wandering kind of attitude. Like one of the things that I've noticed in my life, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have as well, is there's so many great podcasts out there, right? And audio books and so on, that every time I step out the door, I'm like, well, I've got to be listening to something. I've got to be listening, because there's so much I need to listen to. There's so much I need to absorb and take in, so much data I need to download into my head. And I'm like now consciously saying to myself, no, for this 20-minute walk or this run or whatever it is, I'm just not going to listen to anything, because I just want my mind to just do its thing of ticking over and thinking about nothing in particular, but actually kind of everything at the same time. That time is really valuable. It's not wasting time, right? It's not wasting mental time. It's really, really valuable time. You've got to make time for it.
I agree. I do the same sort of thing. I kind of try to listen to my mind in the moment, like, all right, am I thirsty to listen to something right now? Do I kind of want to just let some things sink in? I'll even prompt myself and kind of say, all right, well, during this walk, I'm going to think about this problem. And that doesn't mean I'm going to actively think about it, but I'm kind of handing it off to the subconscious, which is, that's an interesting thing that you brought up, because it's something that I've talked about a lot with a neuroscientist that studies the nature of insights, is that your subconscious mind, they're not totally sure about this, but your subconscious mind perhaps solves creative problems for you while you are doing other things. At the very least, it at least encourages a thing called fixation forgetting, which it helps you forget your bad ideas and then leaves the stronger connections for your good ideas.
I suppose I'm aware. I mean, I think there's quite a lot of evidence now that it's during those times of mind wandering and, of course, sleep, when the neurons start mingling with people they're not supposed to mingle with. Right. They start, it's like some sort of like slightly illicit party goes on, you know.
Well, it's like the frontal lobe is out to lunch, you know, so the rest of the brain can all party. It's a mosh pit.
The frontal lobe leaves to have a long lunch, and everyone's like, oh, okay, let's go and talk to that one over there. Those guys look interesting. And you know, as they get together, they start to create and come up with interesting stuff. And then when you wake up or you come out of your daydream, whatever, the frontal lobe goes, I've just had a wonderful idea. I'm very clever. but actually it's been those guys in the background. So have massive respect, you know, for your
frontal lobe is the Steve Jobs of the brain.
Exactly.
He has that reputation for stealing people's ideas.
Credit,
But it also in that talk, which I mean, I know that thing by heart. Basically, he does talk about trusting that it will, that, you know, your curiosity, as I'm going to just paraphrase, it will take you where you want to go. And that's something that also, when I was talking to that neuroscientist, he was talking about studies where there might be an insight problem and people don't have a solution, but they can predict better than chance whether they will find a solution or whether a solution even exists, because they maybe would be given some problems that don't have a solution. And so that subconscious mind knows better than your conscious mind in some ways sometimes.
Yeah, I think you have to listen to it. There is a, I can't remember which scientist it was now, but it was B.F. Skinner, the great psychologist, father of behaviorism and so on, or one of the fathers of it, who said, when you run into something interesting, drop everything else and study it. So that's a kind of a great kind of working method. It's like, okay, you've set out your research program, you know what you're trying to accomplish, you know how to do it. And I think you do have to do that, right? You have to be methodical in order that you can be unmethodical when the mood strikes you, right? So as soon as you kind of notice something, oh, that's really interesting, then follow that impulse. But only once you've kind of set out the grid. The only thing about the Steve Jobs speech and kind of ethos is that I don't really buy into his, like, you just follow your passion. Because I don't think people necessarily have a passion, right? I mean, some people do, some people don't, right? Probably a lot of people, perhaps even most people don't. But they can gradually accumulate, they can kind of build one out of, you know, over time.
By becoming good at something, basically.
Becoming good at something, by practicing epistemic curiosity, you know, in other words, being patient and having that kind of effortful focus and concentration in order to become good at something, or in order to become deeply knowledgeable about something. And then I think, you know, that sometimes takes a bit of effort, and it can be quite dull sometimes. Sometimes you're kind of learning stuff that you're struggling with. It's not a kind of la la pleasant kind of experience all the time, is what I'm trying to get across. And I sometimes think some of the kind of rhetoric around that kind of Steve Jobs view of the world gives this impression that, oh, you just do all this stuff you really love and, you know, something great will happen. Well, no, not all. You know, usually there are kind of long periods where you're not really sure what you're up to, and you slightly resent having to learn this thing, or you're struggling to understand this, whatever. But there's this kind of payoff. You have to have faith that there's this payoff on the other side. But the effort that you put into epistemic curiosity, I think, is more than worth it.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm very happy to report that Skillshare has renewed as a sponsor for Love Your Work. I know that there are so many listeners out there who are curious types like me, and you never want to stop learning. So that's why Skillshare is perfect for all of you. Skillshare is an online learning community With over 17,000 classes in design, business, and more, you can learn everything from business analytics to social media marketing to street photography. So, like, let's say you have a website and you want to get more traffic. Having rock solid SEO is a great way to do that. I've personally made a lot of money from ranking well on search engines. Skip the Netflix tonight and check out this awesome class from Rand Fishkin from Moz. It's called Introduction to SEO Tactics and Strategy for Entrepreneurs. With Skillshare, you get unlimited access to Rand's class and all the other classes for one low monthly price. You never have to pay per class again. Skillshare is giving my listeners a month of free access, absolutely free. Go to Skillshare.com/loveyourwork to redeem your free month. Skillshare helps keep this podcast free. So please, if they interest you, go to Skillshare.com/loveyourwork so that they know that I sent you. I hope you're enjoying this free episode of Love Your Work. Not only do our sponsors help keep the show free, but so do our Love Your Work Elite members. You could call it a donation, but it's really much more than that. When you join Love Your Work Elite, you get early access to episodes and ad-free interviews, and you even get access to masterclasses with people like Noah Kagan, as well as live monthly office hours hangouts with me and other folks in the community. Our goal is to get 3% of you, just 3% of you, as Love Your Work Elite members. That will help us keep making the show, keep making it free, keep the back catalog free for everyone too. I know that you're mulling it over. You really just are better off deciding and taking action right now. You'll have that mental space left over to think about something else, and you'll just plain feel good to be a bigger part of making the show. So go to lywelite.com to learn more and join. And if you're not in the right context, as David Allen would say, to do that right now, just go ahead and set yourself a reminder. That's lywelite.com. I'll see you there. What you're saying about passion and stuff, that's part of the ethos of this podcast, really. You know, it's called Love Your Work, but that has multiple meanings to it. One of those being that, you know, love the discomfort of doing what it takes to make something that matters in the world. And just because you love to do something doesn't mean that it's going to be easy to actually make a living off of it. I think that you touched on something interesting with the podcasts and the overwhelming amount of information there is to be consumed at any given time. And that's something that sort of encourages this curiosity divide that you were talking about. In the sense that if there's always something new to be consumed, that it becomes difficult to get really focused and interested in one particular thing.
No, I absolutely agree. And you know, you have to kind of think about what your strategy is for accumulating knowledge, right? For reading books, right? For instance, which is I think always going to be a big part of anybody's knowledge accumulation, right? Even in this kind of age of frictionless, information, the act and the effort involved in reading a book is absolutely central to the practice of epistemic curiosity. But that doesn't answer your question, which is, okay, so what books do I read? Because I want to read about everything, right? I want to read about medieval English history. I want to read about machine learning. I want to read, the latest Jonathan Franzen novel. There's a lot of stuff I want to read. And should I kind of just... how do I choose? Because I always have this my Amazon wish list is 30 miles long. And I find it hard sometimes to know what's next. What should I read next? So I don't have a kind of great answer to this, but as I kind of reflect, I think that I'm increasingly of the view that you should cluster your reading. This is something Tyler Cowen, the economist and blogger, talks about. And I think it's a kind of striking idea, which is if you're going to read a book about, Russian history, say you read a biography of Stalin, then, okay, read the biography of Stalin and read another biography of Stalin right after it, or read about the Second World War and Stalin's role in the Second World War, or read a book about the Russian revolution, and you know, Stalin's kind of minor but interesting role in that. Listen to a podcast about the history of Russia. Go to Russia, you know. So cluster your learning around, and actually you will find that because you're making all these different connections and you're looking at the same topic from lots of different angles, that it stays with you. It deepens your learning, and B, it kind of stays with you for much longer, and becomes a real kind of big part of your intellectual life. So rather than just sort of spreading yourself around whatever comes up, comes across my radar, then actually kind of be a bit more strategic about it and say, okay, so for the next couple of months, I'm going to read around this subject and look at it from lots of different angles and make connections. I think that's a kind of a great way to do it.
Yeah, I think you get kind of different maps of information from each of those sources.
Yeah.
And there's parts of them that overlap, and that helps the things sink in. One of the things that I've talked about a bit on this podcast that seems to be resonating with a lot of my listeners is the idea of repetition as well. Which is the basic idea being, if there's a book that you love that you find fascinating, maybe don't read the whole thing over again. If you want to, that's good. But, you know, go back over the highlights of it. If there's some sort of a documentary that you're watching that you found interesting, go ahead and watch it again and again. Actually let that information sink in, and then you have that knowledge more solidified in your brain, which really is the source material for doing any sort of original things.
I mean, you've just articulated it perfectly. I think everything you said there, I fiercely agree with. We underestimate the value of repeating, you know, rerunning, reviewing, whatever, going over the same ground. When you go back to something again, you know, you leave some space in between, but then you go back to it, you will just read it in a different way because you're a different you. But you'll be making all these connections that you weren't making before. And then also what you say about that deeper learning that happens is really important. There's a very, you know, there's very kind of basic relationship, if you look at the cognitive science on this, between time spent paying attention to something and whether or not you remember it, right? It sounds sort of obvious, but it's sort of forgot. Like, if you spend, the more time you spend something reading about something, the more you will remember it. That relationship is incredibly well established. And so, yeah, you're not only kind of reading something in a new light and making new connections, you're really kind of ensuring that it sinks in. And actually the gap in between your reading is important as the rereading, right? So make sure you leave time. Again, there's kind of been interesting research on that in education, sort of scientists who study the way we learn. Who now, you know, they recommend that you teach a lesson, you teach something, and then you leave it for a couple of weeks, and then you go back to it and you teach it again, or you teach something very closely related to it. And the gap in between is as important as going back to it. Again, it's that our friends, you know, the unconscious, the unconscious mind do a huge amount of work in between. So, make sure you kind of go back to stuff and make sure there are spaces in between, and you will learn much a lot more.
I like that spacing idea. I used to use a language learning tool. I think they went out of business, called Pimsleur. But it was fantastic because it would space things out specifically that way so that you could recall them. I like to think of this, I guess, getting knowledge, the same knowledge from a bunch of different angles as kind of constructing a worldview around various topics. And I thought it was interesting. There was a thing that you cited in the book, which actually I had read cited in a book about the neuroscience of insight, about chess masters and the idea that a chess master can look at a chessboard with pieces on it and pretty much memorize where everything is instantly, so long as it's an actual, you know, it's a real scenario. If you randomly put the chess pieces on the board, they're hardly any better than the average person. I think that's That's an interesting thing about learning, is that when you get a, when you construct a worldview about a topic, then you can start to work with it more freely and maybe exploit your knowledge in that more, more readily.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is what it's all about. Your creativity comes from, go back to this neuronal connection thing, you know, the neurons making unusual connections. The great ideas that you have, right, and the best thoughts that you have will come from your long-term memory, your kind of subconscious storehouse of materials, being large enough and rich enough and well-populated enough for there to be many, many more connections than the average person, right? That's why, incidentally, this idea that you sometimes hear that we don't need to go to school, we don't need to learn any facts or information anymore because we can just look it up, and we should concentrate on critical thinking and creativity, in inverted commas, because I don't think these people understand what creativity is nonsense. Creativity comes from having a well-stocked mind, that kind of incredibly well-stocked basement of the subconscious mind. The more you can pack down there below, right, the more kind of amazing and rich and diverse material you have deeply learned over the years, the better at critical thinking, at creativity, at innovation, at imagination, you will be. The more expanded your worldview will be, the smarter you will be, quite frankly, right? So we're not, I think it comes from this kind of misguided idea that the mind works in the same way as a hard drive does, right? If you load up a computer with more information, it starts to slow it down. My Mac's quite slow at the moment. Well, the mind works in the opposite way. The more data, more knowledge it absorbs, the faster it gets, the smarter it gets. And actually, you know, as I say, the more creative and interesting and innovative it gets. So yeah, that I absolutely agree with you that, you know, building that kind of storehouse of knowledge is the kind of key to everything.
Here's the way that I think that I understand it. You can tell me if this sounds right. I think of it as like, I might have got this from your book, as it's kind of managing, you've got long-term memory and then you got your working memory. And if you're going to do the computer analogy, then maybe the working memory is your RAM. Like, you can only hold so much information in your working memory at any given moment. And if coming up with great ideas is the connection of various disparate elements, then it's better to have more stuff in your long-term memory than it is to try to cram the three or four things you can fit in your working memory and try to come up with an insight out of that.
That's exactly what it is, right? So yeah, your working memory is incredibly limited, right? Your conscious memory, the things you can hold in your head, you know, there's that a sort of, George Miller was a psychologist, did some experiments to show that we can basically, on average, hold about seven different things, seven digits in our head maximum, right? And beyond that, we start to, you know, we have to chunk, right? We sort of chunk things. That's how you do mental arithmetic. You kind of group things together and they become one chunk. So effectively, they become one unit. But anyway, we'd have to get into that in detail. All you need to know about that type of memory, that working memory, the conscious memory, the kind of spotlight in your mind that says, I'm focusing on this now, is really limited. It's one of the bits of the brain that evolved kind of last. It's buggy. It's weak. It's really not very good. The incredibly kind of powerful part of the brain is the long-term memory. It's that storehouse. It's what lies beneath, just beneath the kind of conscious mind, but kind of is always kind of sending thoughts up, sending messages up to the conscious mind. And that's what you need to work on cultivating. That's why epistemic curiosity is so important.
You know, you actually had a great example in the book. You gave a string of, I don't know, 7 or 8 numbers. I don't remember them, which is useful for the illustration of how this thing works. And then next you said, try to memorize this string of numbers. Okay, now try to memorize this phrase. And the phrase was Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Yeah. I remember exactly what it was. And the idea being that you have in your working memory these patterns of letters that make up words that, you know, maybe make up lyrics to a song that you've heard before. And because of that, you can remember these, you know, 70 characters or whatever, but you can't remember these 7 or 8 or 9 digits that are together because there's no pattern to it.
Exactly. And, you know, it's a great kind of something I do when I give presentations about curiosity and how the mind works and so on. You know, you can put up just a 12 numbers or whatever and just show it. You can show it for 1 minute, 2 minutes, and it's really, really, really hard, if not impossible, to remember. But yeah, then you put up Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and people get it in like, you switch the screen, you know, or turn the screen to blank after half a second and people have instantly memorized it. Right.
And if you can remember that, if you can remember that digit string, it's because, oh, okay, that was my address.
Yeah,
that was the first 3 digits of my phone number when I was a kid.
It'll be connected to knowledge. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just to emphasize, just in case people are, you know, it's exactly the same problem. It's not, it was because, you know, you say, well, once numbers and once, yeah, but it's like a string of symbols. That's all it is, right? And the fact that one of those strings of symbols you instantly recognize and you kind of integrate into your, it's because you have this deep well of knowledge about, like you say, words, names, grammar, pop music, the Beatles, you know, whatever it is. And so, you know, that's how the mind works. There's this kind of, rich get richer effect in education where, the more you know, the easier it is to learn, right? And this is why I say that, you know, we're not like computers. The more data we have in our kind of database, the faster our machine works, right? The smarter we get, the faster we think. That's why it's worth putting the effort in, because actually the more effort you put in, the smarter you're going to get.
Yeah, this makes a lot of sense to me because I know roughly 2 years ago or so, I really started to dedicate myself more to reading, to reviewing the things that I read, to having conversations with the authors of the books that I read on this podcast, to writing about the things that I read about. And, you know, it's just gotten easier and easier to take in new knowledge as I've gone. It'd be fun to compare notes with you on, so like, what are some of the systems, or like, how do you compile your worldview with all the research and all the different interests that you have? Are there any tools or systems that you use to help your facilitate the learning of all these new things?
No, I mean, I'm terrible when it comes to tools and systems. I'm pretty chaotic. I think I don't say that like as in it's working out great for me. I think I could get a lot better, and I intend to try and get better at organizing the way I learn and organizing my writing and so. I use Pinboard. If you're familiar with that, bookmark.
It's like a delicious.
Delicious has become
fell apart.
Yeah. Pinboard is a very simple, very, but it's become like the kind of, you know, outboard motor of my it's another brain for me because, it's very simple, but as you know, you bookmark stuff and then you tag it. And so whenever I am coming to write about something, I'm just starting to write a piece now about trust and the role of trust in society generally. And then I know I can go to Pinboard, and for the last few years, there's lots of interesting material, research papers, articles, books and so on that I've bookmarked and tagged it with trust. And I know as I go through them that, you know, thoughts and ideas will start popping into my head. So I just have the kind of, I have the kind of method, like I don't have a kind of rigid system, but I do have that kind of approach that I was talking about, which is when I have an article to write or a book to write, whatever it is, my or a problem to solve, spend some time really reading, thinking around it, but don't expect to come up with any answers for a while. So like just read around it, be patient, then take a break, forget about it, go and do something else, work on something else, whatever it is, and then come back to it. And usually by the time you come back to it, you've already kind of worked out the answer, because it will have come to you, you know, in the shower is the classic example, going for a walk, going for a run, or whatever. Intensive kind of research learning, but without getting impatient with yourself for not coming up with great ideas or answers. Taking a break and coming back to it. That's my method insofar as I have one.
I think that's a good way to go about it, by not getting too fixated on a solution. It's actually something that I've written about recently. There's this idea of the four stages of control that has been cited in, you know, just about any paper on creativity in the last 100 years. And it's just this idea that there's preparation, there's incubation, there's illumination, and then there's the verification of it. And so if you're in preparation, if you're collecting information and maybe you're trying a few different ideas and stuff, you're going to hit that impasse. And one of the only ways to make that happen is to step away from it and to get back to it. We're getting pretty close to time here, but I always like to ask my guests, what was the last book that you read that changed the way that you saw something?
I really enjoyed, and it did change the way I saw, Stephen Johnson's latest book, which is called Wonderland. I don't know, you're familiar with Stephen, you must know Stephen Johnson's work.
I'm embarrassed to say that I don't think that I do.
Ah, okay. So let me see. Stephen Johnson is somebody you should have on your podcast. So one of his most famous books is Where Good Ideas Come From, which is all about kind of innovation. What else? Everything Bad Is Good For You, which is all about why computer games and modern technology generally is actually good for the mind, not bad for it. He writes about technology and culture and history, and he's just a great, great kind of polymathic, brilliant storyteller. His latest book is called Wonderland: How Play Made the Modern World. And its theme is play and creativity, or kind of frivolous creativity, play and kind of toys and fun are actually what's the great drivers of modern progress and innovation. We always think of the Industrial Revolution as, you know, being driven by you know, coal and massive machines and turbines and steam engines and so on. And Stephen Johnson says, yeah, okay, but actually it was also driven by things like, female fashion. Lot of great innovations started off as play or something to delight people, you know, some sort of fun, which then developed into life, you know, world-changing things. So it's a whole new way of thinking about, you know, the history of humanity. It's tremendous fun to read. Every page has a fascinating story or fact on it in it, I couldn't recommend it more highly, really.
That sounds awesome. I'm going to set that up at katavi.net/wonderland for any of our listeners, and then of course your book is going to be at katavi.net/curious. Do you have a final message for all of our listeners out there who are trying to wrangle with their curiosity and hope that it leads them to the right place?
I would just say keep wrangling never stop getting excited by what you don't yet know.
Great. And I think you're going to have some new fans from this conversation. Where can they get more of you?
You could Google me and I come up as ian-leslie.com is my website. But I mean, I do tweet quite a lot. So if you're interested in the various bits and pieces of my diverse interests, then come to Twitter. I'm at Mr. Ian Leslie, at Mr. Ian Leslie. And I have a newsletter, but you can see that's on my, you can see that on, at my Twitter site. So join me on Twitter is probably the most straightforward way.
Great. Ian Leslie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much, David.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Ian Leslie, and I hope it helps you make the most of your curiosity. Now, remember, about 15 minutes of our conversation ended up on the cutting room floor. You can get the bonus content by joining Love Your Work Elite at lywelite.com. In particular, in this conversation, I got some gems about writing book proposals.
You can say, oh, well, it's been proven that blah, blah, blah. And you know, you're maybe exaggerating a little bit. And actually, you would never actually want to publish that. But, you know, what you're trying to do with a book proposal is pique somebody's interest and go, you know what? There is definitely a book here.
Again, you can join Love Your Work Elite at lywelite.com. And for more on following your varied interests, listen to Daniel Wilson on episode 87. Daniel has been a cab driver, a conceptual artist, a documentary producer, and is now studying neuroscience.
It's problem solving in a way, right? And your problem is like, how do I get to point B from point A when I don't know what the path looks like? It's a skill kind of finding that path too. The more times you try and do something new, the better you get at kind of developing your pathfinding skills.
Again, Daniel Wilson is on episode 87. I work hard to help you crack the code on fulfilling work. If Love Your Work is helping you, there are some ways you can help support the show and make it even better. One is to subscribe. This is especially effective on Apple Podcasts or iTunes because it boosts rankings and helps others find the show. I know many of you listen on Overcast because you're the early adopter types. So even if you don't listen on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, please subscribe there anyway. Subscribe in your iPhone, your iPad, your Apple TV, your computer. The more devices, the better. It really helps. Apple Podcast ratings help too. Just go to cadavy.net/apple, click on write a review, and click on the star rating. You don't even have to write a review. It just takes a couple of seconds. You can also join Love Your Work Elite. You'll get access to episodes before everyone else. You could even get ad-free interviews weeks in advance, and you can get your name or business mentioned in the credits of the show. For details, go to lywelite.com. That's lywelite.com. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by top Love Your Work Elite members such as Arif Akhtar and Ed Stanfield of startwithclarity.com. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Cadavy. The theme music for the show is More Streets, performed by Spiderflower. Love Your Work is a production of Cadavy, Inc.